Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unmasking of Donald Trump by Donald Trump in an impromptu press conference yesterday in Trump Tower, revealing in public who the president is in private, in spite of the efforts of aides who tried to dispel Trump of his far-right-wing fringe beliefs fed to him by Fox News, Alex Jones, and Breitbart. Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics, who was one of the few journalists to have interviewed Stephen Bannon, who boasted to her that Breitbart was the platform for the alt-right, joins us to discuss how Trump showed his true colors as an ignorant racist with no sense of history or decency, who has debased the presidency and fanned the flames of hate and division in this country by pandering to a violent extremist minority of followers of a genocidal maniac responsible for World War II and the slave masters responsible for America's bloody Civil War. Then we'll examine Trump's reference to Southern heritage in his claims that there were, quote, very fine people in Charlottesville protesting the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, decrying that in doing so, quote, you are changing history, you are changing culture. Karen Cox, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, joins us to discuss the mythology of the Confederacy Trump espoused, where the institution of slavery is whitewashed in the name of a noble lost cause, and her article at the New York Times, Why Confederate Monuments Must Fall. Then finally, we'll look into the move by Jeff Sessions' Justice Department to demand that the web hosting company DreamHost turn over data detailing all visits to an anti-Trump protest website. Mark Rodenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, joins us to discuss whether DreamHost will prevail in its refusal to comply with a government warrant on the basis that Trump's DOJ is seeking, quote, to identify political dissidents of the current administration. And joining us now, Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Hi, Ian. Thanks.
So yesterday in Trump Tower, Donald Trump had this extraordinary outburst with the press, and many people, myself included, believe that the mask is finally off, that this is actually who this man is and how he is inside the Oval Office and inside the private conclaves of his meetings with his staff. And a lot of us, including pundits in the press, have taken some comfort in the idea that there are adults in the room who are able to dissuade Donald Trump of the apparently insane stuff that he believes that Alex Jones and other fringe ideologues spout. But apparently that is not true. Apparently he cannot be contained, and he just showed his true colors yesterday. So I'm just trying to digest this. Just, it's a shocking recognition that our president is the hater in chief.
Well, I think that we have known that for a very long time. It's just that the people around him have done minimally competent job at restraining him publicly. Obviously, yesterday the veil completely came off, and according to the New York Times reporting, the aides who, I guess, had been trying to rein him in a little bit were, in the words of the New York Times, stunned that he had engaged in this very public outburst of things that he says frequently privately, which raises a lot of questions about why would you even work for someone who says those things privately, if not publicly, and your job is to prevent him from saying them out loud to the public. He's the president of the United States. I mean, it is such a travesty and a scandal beyond words that these people work for him with the express purpose of trying to stop him from saying these odious things they know he says and thinks in private, in public. So maybe, you know, it's done the nation a favor. They see what he's like in public now, and now everyone can see for themselves the real Donald Trump. But the reality is that we've known this all along. We've known all along that he thrilled white supremacists with his campaign, that he thrilled them with his election. And while he hasn't thrilled them with every single thing he's done in office, he thrilled them with that statement yesterday. So I don't think that there's any more head-scratching to be done about who Donald Trump is. He is someone who has the back of Nazis and white supremacists.
But in terms of defending the adults in the room, the generals in particular, two Marine generals, Kelly and Mattis, and an Army General, McMaster, they, of course, sworn allegiance to the Constitution. And
so is Trump.
I agree, but their background is such that they would, I think, recognize that he is the commander-in-chief. He was elected by the American people, for better or for worse. So what do you do in that situation? Because if those guys, even though they're not stepping up to the plate sufficiently, if they abandon the field and do what you're suggesting, just quit because he's so disgusting, then there'll be more Sebastian Gorkas and Stephen Bannon and Stephen Millers even in higher positions in the White House.
Okay, listen. So it is the responsibility of Congress to impeach him, right? So anybody who works for Trump, and when I was talking a couple minutes ago, I wasn't speaking specifically about the ex-military guys who work for him. I was talking about, like, every single person in the White House with him, whoever it is who's, you know, whispering in Maggie Haberman's ear that they can't, you know, that they don't want him to say the things he says in private, in public. All of those people have an obligation to our country and to our Constitution to go to Congress and say, look, here is who he is. This is what he says every day in meetings. He's unfit to serve as president. Impeach him today. That's not happening. It doesn't have to be something by the generals. These are civilians who are sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they're Republicans. They are, you know, integral part of the Republican Party apparatus. Nothing is stopping them from going to Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell and telling them what the real deal is and what really needs to be done. I mean, this is just like, this is beyond the whole, you know, hand-wringing and what is the base going to think and all the rest of the BS that we've heard for 7 months now. This is a crisis, and they're simply in dereliction of their duty to the Constitution and to the United States of America.
Well, indeed, Sarah Posner, your words were echoed last night on MSNBC by Nicole Wallace, who was the former communications head for George W. Bush. And she was outraged and saying, where are these people? When are they going to step up? This is unacceptable. And she was holding up a transcript of Trump's remarks in Trump Tower. It is a moment of crisis. And it's for somebody like myself who follows foreign policy, it's just heartbreaking to see how the rest of the world sees America and what damage this man has done to America's position in the world, because it took the leader of Germany to step up and fill the vacuum of moral leadership that Donald Trump has abdicated and abandoned. I'm talking about Angela Merkel's remarks about Charlottesville. What does it come to when a foreign leader has to stand up for the decency of America?
It is the great shame of America that this man is our president. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. I mean, there's nothing else to say about it. The fact that the Republicans are sitting on their hands in fear of a base that they fear will institute a backlash against them because they take action against a president who defended Nazis and white supremacists. I mean, this is madness. This is just madness.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. So what is the logic of pandering to the base, which apparently is what Stephen Bannon and others urged Trump to do, but now I think that the mask is off. It's clear that they don't have to, that he's actually in bed with them. But he's in bed with an extremely small minority. That's what I understand. So is it the fear on the part of Republicans that the people that showed up in Charlottesville with guns and shouting Nazi slogans and waving swastikas will descend on their town hall meetings?
No. That's not what they're afraid of. But the idea that taking down Confederate statues is somehow violates the heritage or the historical memory of white people in America is a view that is held by people who wouldn't, you know, be categorized as someone who, you know, who wouldn't go to a rally carrying a torch. I mean, like, that's a wider held belief than people who would go to a rally like that, right? And so I think that Trump has managed to enthrall his base by kind of a combination of things. So yes, like, he has enthralled this base of extremists and normalized them, I should add. But I think that what he says and what he's done also appeals to less extreme people who still have racial resentments and anxieties that aren't expressed as extremely as the people you saw in Charlottesville this weekend. So I think that you know, Trump is counting on those people continuing to support him, and he needs to continue to engage in the whataboutism, you know, basically saying, well, what about the left-wing violence, or what about the fake news that's not treating me fairly? And that's how he kind of keeps that less extreme part of his base in his camp, because he portrays himself as a victim of political correctness or any of his other demons that he brought up on the campaign trail, or now fake news. And he's counting on that to maintain their sympathies.
Well, he is basically engaging in the same kind of distortions that the neo-Nazis and the so-called alt-right do. And I don't know whether you saw the Vice News piece that they embedded a young reporter with the Nazis in both the Friday night rally and throughout the entire weekend. And it is the most shocking and real stuff. And I just, when I saw that, I thought, my God, they ought to force Trump to watch this. Because at his press conference in the Trump Tower yesterday, where he revealed his true colors, he went on about how he'd seen all the footage. Well, I bet you he has not seen this Vice News footage. These Nazis were speaking openly and honestly, and it is beyond chilling. And it is so ugly, their belief system. And the idea that there's any equivalence to what these people say and feel and believe is beyond belief. But you have done us all a great service, Sarah Posner, because you're the only reporter that ever got Stephen Bannon on the record. And you interviewed him at the Republican convention where he said that Breitbart News is the platform for the alt-right. Now, he's holed up in the Eisenhower building, and he doesn't talk to anybody in the press, although the press cover him a lot. And he's very much the subject of the inside baseball obsession about who's up and who's down in terms of the palace intrigue. But what's your sense then of where this palace, here I am, guilty of the same question. What's your sense of of whether or not there will be any house cleaning there? Because Trump again has said today that what he said yesterday is absolutely what he feels, and he has no apologies. So nobody's been able to rein him in. My sense about Bannon is there's no way that Trump's going to fire him, because the biggest backer of Trump, Robert Mercer, who's put up hundreds of millions to get this guy elected and is prepared to put up $300 million just to defeat an errant Republican Senator, Jeff Flake, Bannon is his protege, and surely Mercer pulls the strings as much as anybody, along with
I think there's a different reason, actually, why Trump won't fire Bannon. And even if he did fire Bannon, it wouldn't make any difference, because Trump is Trump, and he's not going to change, okay? But the reason, I think, why he wouldn't fire Bannon is Bannon is extremely dangerous to him outside the White House, because if Bannon decided to turn on him for firing him, he could basically direct an online army of one-time Trump supporters to see Trump as a traitor. So, a traitor to their cause by firing Bannon. So I think that Trump finds himself in a difficult position when it comes to Bannon because of that risk to him. But the reality is, I mean, like, yes, I know there are all these groups who are calling on Trump to fire Bannon, but it doesn't, like, it won't make any difference. I mean, Bannon doesn't have, he's not a cabinet secretary who's setting policy. He's an advisor to the president. And what he advises the president is basically, you know, what the president kind of already thinks. So it's not like getting rid of him is going to change Donald Trump the person. So, you know, yes, it would be symbolic if he fired him, obviously, but it's not going to change the way Trump behaves. It might make someone like John Kelly feel like he has more control over Trump, but let's face it, no one has control over Trump, whether Bannon is in or out.
And that includes Ivanka and Jared, right?
It especially includes Ivanka and Jared.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is then the logic of what Trump is doing, pandering to this base of his? We hear that they're down to 35%, or his popularity is down to 35%, but yet it's around 80% with Republicans. So the math is a little confusing. But is there a strategy behind this, or is this just Trump plugging up a leaking lifeboat?
This is who Trump is. I think that that's the answer to that question. I mean, he may be looking at it as, these are the only people who like me, and we know that, you know, Trump thrives on praise and
flattery.
Flattery. And so I think he partially looks at it like that, like, these are my people, these are the people who like me and will say nice things about me. But I also think that he is just behaving in a way that comes naturally to him. It's not like a well thought out political strategy where he thinks, okay, well, like, this is the way I keep my base. I think it's more just like, this is who I am, and this is how I've acted all my life, and I've had lots of success. I got elected president of the United States acting this way, so I'll just keep doing it.
So can we then dispense with a lot of the analysis trying to figure out who this guy is and why he does what he did, particularly going back to the Bertha situation, and just sort of connect the dots going back to his father, Fred Trump, who was clearly a racist and was charged with racist behavior in terms of public housing. The government had subsidized his business. Then you go to Trump's full-page ad in the New York Times attacking these kids in Central Park who, in fact, were innocent.
Right.
And then you go to the Bertha thing, which never made any sense. You know, very hard to figure out why he did that. Some people say it was because Obama made a fool of him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. But that doesn't seem to be sufficient. If you look at all those things in context and try and connect the dots there, does one have to come to the conclusion that this man is a racist?
Yes.
So what do we do with a racist in the most powerful office in the world and the leader of our country?
I think it's obvious that now it's not just that he's a racist. It's that he has given accolades, essentially, to Nazis and white supremacists. He's completely unstable, unfit to serve in the office. I mean, I don't see how anybody could come to the conclusion, any conclusion other than he must be removed from office.
But the people that are in the Vice News special that I referenced,
right,
at the end, one of the leading Nazis, who one of the organizers of this horrible event over the weekend in Charlottesville, he's back home unpacking, and he pulls out a whole bunch of assault rifles, and then guns keep popping out from every, under his belt, under his jacket, out of his shoe, all over the place. And then he defends what happened when that car rammed into all of those people, injuring 19 seriously and killing this young woman. He blamed it on the demonstrators, and he said, "We're coming back. We're going to come back stronger than ever."
I was in Charlottesville. I was in the back of the marchers who were hit by that car. It was a very big group. It was a completely peaceful group. No one was carrying any weapons. They were marching down the street chanting when that car rammed into them. And I heard it happen. I was in the back of that group. The people in the back did not know what it was. I was there. I was covering it. I heard it. we didn't know what it was at first. Right before that happened, I had been in a parking lot a block away from there where there were several, you know, there were, I mean, not just in that parking lot, but all over the streets of Charlottesville that morning, there were people, heavily armed, I'm like with, you know, ammo strapped across their bodies and long guns and such. I mean, it was, the amount of weaponry that I saw when I was there was like astonishing. So it doesn't surprise me that this vice reporter found this guy was carrying even more than what he was open carrying. So, you know, the blaming of the marchers and the blaming of the so-called, you know, alt-left, which isn't even a thing, for provoking these Nazis to violence is just just sick. There were some Antifa protesters there, and there were Antifa protesters who were carrying, at least what I saw, you know, clubs and sticks. And I didn't see, but I heard that some of them had pepper spray. But the vast majority of the people who were there protesting the Nazis were just ordinary citizens who were not Antifa anarchists. And they had come with their church or with their synagogue or just with their neighbors or just with some peace and justice group or what have you. And there were also people there who considered themselves part of the Antifa, anti-fascist movement who were not violent, too. And the vast majority of the people were not violent people who were physically attacking or physically fighting with the Nazi group. So that needs to be made absolutely clear. It was the Nazi group who came to Charlottesville and without a permit or permission and completely lawlessly took that torch march on the grounds of the UVA grounds. And, you know, for them to say that somebody else were the instigators of anything is just preposterous.
Well, just in closing, I wanted to ask you, though, about what will happen and how do we get to the point, if there's only 35% of the supporters of Trump, what about the other 65%? But even if we can impeach this man and force the Republicans into showing some decency and finding their backbones, you still have a situation where you've got probably 35% of the country, and some of which are heavily armed, like these people, who will be angry and feel that their hero has been unjustly taken away from them. How do you overcome that? Is there any way to reach these people in a way that can heal this country?
Well, I don't think that 35% of the American public is going to be violent if Trump is impeached. They might be angry, but I don't think 35% of the public will be violent. And I think it remains to be seen now, post-Charlottesville, what happens to his approval ratings. That 35% number might grow smaller. But I do think you raise a really important point that for supporters of Trump who are violent, are carrying weapons, that's a real serious concern, but I think it's a serious concern. The possibility of violence remains a serious concern, even if Trump isn't impeached, I think, as was obvious this weekend. But I think as far as the anger, non-violent anger of people who support Trump should he be removed from office, it is real, and I think that there are a lot of right-wing news sites and organizations and social media that will get them whipped up into a frenzy with conspiracy theories and fake news theories and all of that. And it's a very dangerous situation. I mean, I don't mean dangerous just physically dangerous for people, which it is, but it's dangerous in terms of what people are able to see as truth and reality and what the role of the press is and what the role of the three branches of government are. So, you know, I think we're headed into some very uncertain times, and I don't want to be too gloomy or pessimistic, but, you know, I think there's not... It's going to be a very long and difficult process, I believe.
Well, Sarah Posner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining Trump's reference to Southern heritage and the mythology of the Confederacy, where the institution of slavery is whitewashed in the name of a noble lost cause. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Karen Cox, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and the author most recently of Goat's Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South. She has an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Confederate Monuments Must Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen Cox.
Thank you.
And ostensibly, the reason why the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists showed up in Charlottesville was to protest plans by the city of Charlottesville to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general and the leader of the Confederate Army in the Civil War. And it apparently there's a move across the country to do this in many states, including North Carolina. But what is this idea that seems to be expressed by President Trump yesterday in his impromptu news conference in Trump Tower, where he conflated Robert E. Lee with George Washington, the founding father, and Thomas Jefferson, saying, you know, today is Robert E. Lee, and the next thing they're going to be doing is taking down statues of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Isn't there as an historian, surely there's a fundamental difference between the founding fathers of this country and the person who tore this country apart, in effect, the traitor who started the Civil War?
It's just an example of historical illiteracy about who these people are and what these monuments stood for. To conflate the two is an error, you know, historically, and they're very, very different. You know, historians have been weighing on this recently. You know, the truth of the matter is the monuments to Confederate soldiers, Confederate generals, et cetera, are really about people who sought to break away from the nation, which makes them quite different than people like the founding fathers. They regarded the Civil War, historians do, at least among the people who were engaged in it, as sort of like a second American Revolution, except this time, the American South had pulled away. And so there is a fundamental difference. There's also a fundamental difference in that while certainly George Washington and Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, it's not the same as engaging in a war to preserve slavery, which the leaders of the Confederacy were involved in.
So what is this word heritage that's used so often? And the president used it yesterday, and I believe it's a sort of buzzword, if not a euphemism, for Southern values, if you will, in terms of the white South going back to the Confederacy.
Well, heritage is just the word itself is really could be applied to a lot of different types of I think it's about historical memory more than anything else. It's not necessarily history. Heritage often involves some emotional, visceral response to the past, very often because people have a personal connection to it. And so in this country, beginning in the 1890s, there were Confederate heritage organizations being formed, like the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans. But there were also heritage organizations like the Colonial Dames or the Daughters of the American Revolution or Sons of the American Revolution that are we would consider heritage organizations. And those types of organizations are based on individual lineage and people's having a personal connection to an ancestor who participated in those events.
Well, in your near you in Durham, North Carolina, a group of people literally, as you point out in your article in the New York Times, Karen Cox, they took matters into their own hands. Apparently, the legislature had been somewhat dawdling with this issue, having passed a law in 2015 prohibiting the removal of monuments. I saw it on TV. They tore down a statue of a Confederate soldier, and then the protesters sort of kicked it and punched it. Of course, being made of bronze, it seemed like they were actually getting a stubbed toes, if you will. But what is the resistance then? I mean, I guess there's two sides, not to quote Donald Trump, but there are two sides. There are people that tore down the Confederate soldier in Durham, North Carolina, but there are also people who are resisting the removal of these statues, as what we saw with the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville.
Right. Well, there have long been heritage organizations, but who are now joined by people from outside of the South, as the events in Charlottesville reflected, who are joining in on the cause. And so within the South, there's not been much movement, even you know, despite what happened in Charleston in 2015. And so the numbers of people that have belonged into these kind of Southern heritage groups is really unclear. I don't think they're that large in number. But when they've been joined by white nationalists from outside of the region, then it becomes a kind of it becomes a different thing altogether. And so there's that group on that side. The people on the other side, the people who protested and the people who yanked down the monument in Durham, should, you know, signal to the rest of America that the South is not a monolith when it comes to their political points of view. And so there are Southerners, white and black and of different classes, who will all are in agreement on, you know, what should be done with these monuments. Not everybody's going to agree, but this is the thing. There's this assumption, there has been an assumption that the entire white South reveres these monuments, and that's just simply not true. And so you saw that reflected in Durham with people taking that monument down and, you know, pulling in and kicking it and doing, it looked pretty awful by the end of it. So those are sort of the two sides of it. And so, you know, it's hard to say, you know, what the numbers are on each side, because what we're seeing is the media is like certainly honed in on these white nationalist rallies, and they're beginning to spring up in different cities across the South where there's a threat of, you know, monument removal. But as Baltimore showed us just yesterday or last night, if they want to do it, if local officials want to do something about that, they can go in and take them in the dark at night, and this is what they did. But in places like here in North Carolina in 2015, where they passed a law that you know to protect monuments, that people can be prosecuted for that. And currently, our governor, who's a Democrat, but he's up against a majority Republican legislature, is calling for some sort of removal. He's calling first for to get rid of that law and then move forward on removing monuments, which exist on the state capitol grounds, as they do in many states, on state and local courthouses, for example.
Well, of course, the governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, was so horrified by what happened in Charlottesville that he wants to remove all the Confederate monuments in the state, but obviously he will face a lot of resistance. But they haven't fallen, of all places, in the nation's capital, in the National Statuary Hall, where there are a number of Southern including Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate South, along with Rose Stevens and Vance and Wheeler, some of whom have hideous histories of, for example, Confederate cavalryman Joseph Wheeler. He was responsible for a massacre of freed slaves in Ebenezer Creek in 1864, and yet there he is in the nation's capital. So it would seem to me that if we really want a clean house here, we ought to start with the nation's capital.
Well, I imagine that that question is going to keep coming up until some decision is made about it. Those were placed in the early 20th century during the era of Jim Crow when, you know, all states were asked to submit, you know, two names or, you know, to represent their state, so that there would be figures of these individuals, and which is why you have many of the people that you named in the Capitol. So, yeah, I'm not even sure where one would start there, and I imagine it will have to go through some sort of legislative bureaucracy before anything happens. But it's going to require, you know, Americans in different states to speak up to their representatives about making changes in the Capitol where those monuments are concerned.
Well, Karen, since you are in the South and you are an historian, can you just sort of give us an idea of what it is to have this nostalgia for the so-called lost cause, the mythology of the Confederacy, as you write, describing it in your op-ed piece in the New York Times as a grand patriarchal civilization? I recall a movie was made about the Civil War from the point of view of what life was like in the South. It was called Cold Mountain. And there was a scene in the movie where this doctor was tending to all of these Confederate wounded in a converted, antebellum mansion. And these sort of Scarlett O'Hara women in their big hoop skirts were sort of in there helping, doing charity work. And there were all these horribly wounded young Confederate soldiers around. And the doctor says, you know, I just can't believe that these young boys died for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves. So how can one reconcile that illogic?
Well, I don't know, you know, that particular statement about replacing them with slaves, but I will say this. I think more recently in the film The Free State of Jones, there's a statement being made, you know, because that was a particular county in Mississippi that seceded from Mississippi, who made this claim about why he understood, the leader of this group understood, that what they were fighting for was defense of the system of slavery that really only benefited a small percentage of men in the South, and that there was more in common, you know, because he gets together with a band of, his name is Newt Knight, and he gets together with a band of, you know, also of runaway slaves to kind of, you know, defend themselves against, you know, even the Confederate Army. So it's, I think there were people that understood it, but what has happened in the last century and a half is that the war has been, and the reasons people have gone to war have been romanticized. There's a, you know, the mythology that's attached to it is entrenched in Southern culture. Not for everyone, but even people who are well educated have a sympathy to these sorts of things because perhaps they had an ancestor fight for the Confederacy, for example. Or, for example, that because most of the war was fought on Southern soil, that there was a lot of suffering. But there's, you know, they often neglect to consider the suffering of 4 million slaves for centuries.
Right, and in terms of casualties, it was at roughly 800,000 died, more on the northern side than the southern side. And per capita, that still to this day is a greater ratio of war casualties and death than all of America's other wars combined. So there's no escaping what a horrible experience that Civil War was. I mean, you can't emphasize enough what a terrible trauma was brought about by these people aloft on that statue like Robert E. Lee.
Yeah. Well, and plus, not to, you know, to think about, you know, so many people dying because of just the, you know, the poor medical treatment or the lack of it that they could get when they, you know, had a bullet wound or whatever. So So, yeah, there's a lot of suffering on both sides. But, you know, the thing that gets lost in the Lost Cause is the issue of slavery. And those white people who tend to buy into the myth of the Lost Cause also buy into the myth of this idea of faithful slaves, that, you know, somehow it wasn't as bad as history makes it out to be. So they've romanticized the relationship between planter and slave. And so that, too, is problematic within this Lost Cause mythology.
Well, Karen Cox, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Karen Cox, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and the author most recently of Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Why Confederate Monuments Must Fall. Going to take a brief station break and back, looking into the move by Jeff Sessions' Justice Department to demand that the web hosting company DreamHost turn over data detailing all visits to an anti-Trump protest website. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Rodenberg, who is the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the Expert Panel on Cryptography Policy and Computer Security for the OECD and the Legal Experts on Cyberspace Law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice to be with you.
And Mark, what do you make of this attempt on the part of the Jeff Sessions Department of Justice to demand that the internet hosting service DreamHost turn over the identities of effectively what DreamHost is saying, the identities of political dissidents of the current administration, specifically they want about 1.3 million IP logs from DreamHost of those that had visited an anti-Trump website who apparently had something to do with organizing some protests, particularly in and around the inauguration.
Well, it's a very concerning development. What the Department of Justice is trying to do is uncover the identity of people who engaged in political protest by going to an internet company which would have perhaps records of some of the online identities related to the IP address, which of course is the Internet Protocol address. We find it chilling at multiple levels. First of all, the First Amendment is the cornerstone of political freedom in the United States. And the premise of the First Amendment, of course, is that people do have the right to engage in political activity without repercussion or government investigation. So even before we get to the internet issue, I think we have to understand that for the Department of Justice to go after political protesters is clearly a problem. And, of course, we'll talk as well about the particular technique and how they're trying to identify people by means of the IP address.
But your organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, has filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court urging the Supreme Court to safeguard the First Amendment right to read in the digital era. Is that to say that the law has not caught up with technology?
Well, I think as a general matter, that's correct. In fact, EPIC, you know, my organization has filed many briefs before the Supreme Court over several years around Fourth Amendment search issues. And oftentimes in these cases, which increasingly involve cell phone service and internet service, we point out that when the government seeks to exercise a search, which is traditionally thought of as a Fourth Amendment activity, there are oftentimes also First Amendment implications, because when they search for information about individuals engaging in political activity, that's what triggers the First Amendment interest. We did very recently, this past week, file a brief in the Supreme Court in a case called Carpenter versus the United States. And that case poses a fundamental question, which is whether our Fourth Amendment protections for the contents of the communications of our calls will also protect the records associated with our calls. And you see, in this particular case, now in the D.C. Superior Court, one of the key questions is whether there are constitutional protections that limit the ability of the government to get access to the details of the calls, even though that may not be the content of the communication.
So specifically, there was a site, I believe it was called, the website was DisruptJ20.org, and it served as a clearinghouse for activists who were mobilizing resistance to President Trump's inauguration on January the 30th. And as we saw on television, there were street demonstrations, etc. And you can't help noticing, Mark Rotenberg, that the very people that Donald Trump made an attack on yesterday in this impromptu press conference in Trump Tower, where he again equated the Nazis and white supremacists with the other side. In this case, Trump even went further to refer to them as the alt-left. So is there a possibility here that because Trump has this obviously unshakable belief that there is equal blame on all sides, as he said, that he's somehow trying to prove that these people are just as bad as the Nazis, and he's directed Sessions to do this? I mean,
Well, let me begin by saying that it would be a separate concern and a grave concern if the investigations undertaken by the Attorney General were directed by the White House. That simply is not supposed to take place in our country. The Attorney General operates pursuant to legal authorities, prosecutorial priorities. There are a number of rules regarding the circumstances under which investigations are to be pursued or not to be pursued. But one of the fundamental rules about the use of the Department of Justice's enormous resources to undertake and pursue prosecution is that they may not be directed by the White House. In fact, communications between the Attorney General and the White House are almost inherently suspect. This is one of the issues that is, you know, of course, returned to the Attorney General, Mr. Sessions, and growing concerns about what may have been said earlier between the president and him. But I need to underscore this point, because it would go to the professional responsibility and the obligations not only of the Attorney General, but the people who are working in the Department of Justice. They could not undertake an investigation pursuant to the direction of the president.
So it's just a coincidence that Jeff Sessions, DOJ, is looking for the identities of the very same people that Donald Trump is blaming equally for the outrages that took place in Charlottesville over the weekend.
Well, that, of course, is a clever statement, and I'm not prepared to say that it's a coincidence either. Mm-hmm. It may be, in fact, a situation that the Attorney General has, you know, taken a lead from the president and believes that he therefore has to undertake this investigation. But as I said, this would actually go to the professional conduct of the Attorney General if he were to pursue his prosecutorial activities on that basis. And it would be a problem, you know, quite severe, but also separate from the decision of the Department of Justice to pursue information linking to those engaged in political protest.
So let's, Mark, just talk about where this situation stands now with Dream Host refusing to comply with the government's warrant, demanding that they turn over these 1.3 million IP logs to find out who these protesters are and or were going back to the inauguration. Dream Host has argued that the prosecutors are attempting to, quote, to identify the political dissidents of the current administration. Where does it stand in terms, because I think that already a judge has a judge already ruled against Dream Host?
No. Well, the judge in the D.C. Superior Court agreed to issue the subpoena when the Department of Justice approached the judge with jurisdiction over the company. The judge said, okay, I see adequate legal authority to grant the subpoena. It actually surprised, I think, a number of legal experts that he made that decision. As I said, it's a very unusual circumstance to make this type of request in these circumstances. And I think the view of the legal experts is that the judge likely should have denied the request from the Department of Justice. So what happened next is that the internet company DreamHost receives a subpoena, which is essentially a legal order instructing the company to turn over the IP records that would make it possible to identify internet users. And DreamHost says no. They said that they will oppose the order. And another judge has agreed, actually I believe the chief judge of the D.C. Superior Court has agreed to hold a hearing, which was originally scheduled for this Friday. I believe it's been postponed to next week. And now we have a very interesting situation because many of the civil liberties and privacy groups and internet companies are siding with DreamHost, and they're saying that the company was correct to oppose the subpoena. And, of course, they're also concerned, you see, because this could be a precedent-setting case. The Department of Justice has the ability here to get access to the names of people engaged in political protests, and they could go to many other internet companies with similar authority and make similar requests. So I think the stakes are high. I think it's right that people are concerned about this. I think the Department of Justice has exceeded its authority, and engagement activities that clearly implicate First Amendment interests. Our view here at EPIC is that the very best way to protect privacy, of course, is not to retain the personal information about internet users, because in keeping this information, the web logs and the IP addresses, DreamHost has created a target for the government prosecutors to get access. And if the information were not retained, essentially if it were ephemeral, then the ability of the government to get access to this data would be significantly diminished. So we certainly credit the company for opposing the subpoena. The Department of Justice was wrong to seek this information, but at the same time, we would also encourage internet companies such as DreamHost to seriously consider the extent to which they can minimize the data about their customers that they choose to keep.
But how would this relate to these cloud services? I mean, I thought that was the whole point of these internet web hosting, that they did retain data.
Well, I think we need to distinguish, of course, between the content and the files that people may store in the cloud and access in the cloud, and the transactions associated with the particular access by an internet user to a file or record. And it's those transactional records, you see, that the government is trying to obtain. That's the information about, certain users who are going to certain websites. And we think the better practice is that that data not be retained.
So, but EPIC has already gone down this path before, haven't you? In 2006, you opposed a similar government demand, which they later dropped, for a week's worth of search queries into Google. So this is not unique in the sense that this is the Trump administration, DOJ.
No, this is not. That's correct. And I believe we have an item at our website, which is epic.org, where we provide a bit of that history. And I remember this. I mean, this was, more than 10 years ago. This was President Bush's Department of Justice, and this was actually the early days of internet search. and they were trying to enforce, I think, an anti-abortion statute, and they wanted to try to determine who may be getting access to websites that raise some suspicion. They made an extraordinary request to Google at that time. They requested 2 months of search history for all of their users. They said, in effect, give us all of this information, and we will decide, what of this information is useful for our investigation. And Google rightly opposed it, and we joined with them and others and spoke out against the Department of Justice's excessive attempts to gather user data from an Internet company. I'll say 10 years ago, actually, Google was quite a small company. Of course, today it dominates the Internet. But back in those days, we said this is wrong, and the Department of Justice eventually backed off that request, which was the correct thing to do. I know there are a lot of groups across the country that are writing to the Attorney General, Mr. Sessions, and urging him to seriously consider dropping this request. It's a very unusual request, as I said, in the United States, to try to uncover the identity of people expressing their political views through protest. We don't typically do this.
Well, it gets to the notion, doesn't it, of any citizen who visits a website, could come back to haunt you. I mean, I know, for example, the Russian intelligence service, the FSB, they frame people by putting, child porn and stuff on their websites to then accuse them to get to, that's what they do with political dissidents. So the idea that the government can search around and find out what websites you visited is just chilling in itself, isn't it?
Well, I agree, of course. It is chilling. And I don't think that people should take the view that therefore they need to be more cautious about the websites they visit or what they say on the Internet. You know, we've been at these issues for a long time. I remember the case back in the 1990s against the Department of Justice. And by the way, it was the Clinton Justice Department in those days. So both parties, of course, can engage in excess. And they tried to limit the type of information that was available on the Internet. And we opposed that. It was an important victory, actually a decision of the Supreme Court in 1997 that protected the First Amendment on the Internet. So our view is that people should have the freedom to express their views. They should be held accountable for their acts. I'm not suggesting that the Department of Justice doesn't have the authority to investigate criminal conduct, but there's nothing that I've seen so far about this case that suggests actual criminal conduct. I think this is largely a case about, individuals and organizations who have expressed opposition to the Internet, and the Attorney General is trying to uncover their identities. And this is not something that should be permitted.
Well, Mark Rotenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Nice speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including expert panel on cryptography, policy, and computer security at the OECD and legal experts on cybersecurity at UNESCO. And he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.